This is Tribeca Talks, our favorite conversations recorded live at the Tribeca Film Festival. I'm Leah Sarbib. Multi-platinum musician John Legend says that luck is when preparation meets opportunity. And he has been prepared for some amazing opportunities. The first record he ever played on was The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. Since then, he's won 11 Grammy Awards, an Academy Award, a Golden Globe, a Tony, and an Emmy, making him the first African-American man to earn an EGOT. He's a partner in Get Lifted Film Company and served as an executive producer for films including United States and La La Land, which he also acted in. He starred in NBC's Jesus Christ Superstar Live in Concert with Sarah Bareilles in 2018. 2 weeks later, she interviewed him as part of Tribeca's Storyteller series. Sarah Bareilles is a Grammy Award-winning artist known for her breakout hit Love Song and for writing the music and lyrics for the Broadway show Waitress.
Hi, everyone. I forgot I'm wearing a microphone, so I can start talking now. But I guarantee some of this is going to be awkward because I have no idea what the hell I'm doing up here.
We're going to have fun.
That's why we brought some wine.
Yes.
Did you guys get wine
cheers,
on the way
everybody.
In?
Cheers, everybody.
No, cheers. Start there.
All right.
All right. Well, John.
Sarah.
We're going to have a conversation, but I did bring questions. And I think we should start at the beginning, because who doesn't want to know a little bit about, like, where you came from?
The beginning. So I grew up in a town called Springfield, Ohio.
Are you guys from Ohio? Or are you just big fans?
You're from Springfield, too? Oh, my God. It's so rare. I was at an event in San Diego, and, like, one person cheered when I said I was from Springfield. And now we're like four or five in here.
Yeah, we're growing.
We're doing really well.
Are you guys fans over there? Are you sports fans? Because I know John is a big...
I'm a big Ohio State fan.
Yeah.
OH, yes. Yes. Anyway, we'll talk to the rest of the audience too. No, but I grew up in Springfield, Ohio. My family basically ran the church that I grew up in. So I grew up in the church. My grandfather was the pastor. My grandmother was the organist. My mother was the choir director.
Oh, wow.
My dad taught Sunday school and played the drums and sang in the choir too. And my uncle, who was my mother's older brother, he ended up taking over as pastor once my grandfather retired. So I grew up in this church called El Bethel Temple. It's a Pentecostal church. And I grew up singing and playing music in the church. And so a lot of my start as a musician came from that experience. And my dad was a factory worker by day. He worked building trucks at a place called International Harvester, which became Navistar. And my mother stayed at home with us, and she also made clothes, and both of my parents actually were tailors. And
that's why you dress so well.
they made us care about clothes from a very young age. and they made our clothes, and I had a really strong affinity toward cowboy costumes when I was young for some reason. And
like full hat?
Yeah,
like,
they made me
the
cowboy
outfit.
Yeah, everything. With a gun holster and everything.
Yeah.
And I had these cowboy boots, and I would wear them even with non-cowboy outfits. I would wear cowboy boots just
well, that's just a good look.
I was like a weird five-year-old. But but that all came from my parents making me cowboy clothes.
Now, did you guys play music at home?
Yeah.
Or was it sort of... Like,
it was at
like,
home.
Did your dad have a drum set?
We had a drum set at the house.
That's the coolest.
It was a loud drum set in the basement. And then we had a piano up in the living room. And my brother was taking piano lessons, but he decided he didn't want to take them anymore and wanted to take drum lessons. And I was like 4 years old, and I was like, Dad, I want to take piano lessons. Can I take piano lessons? And I started back then, and then I've been playing ever since.
Wow.
How about you? When did you start playing and singing and writing?
Well, let's make it about me.
Yes.
I started playing young as well. I think it's interesting because we had a piano in the house, but nobody was... We didn't listen to a lot of music, but like my dad would play the piano and my older sister played piano, and I think I was just kind of wanting to follow in her footsteps, to be honest. And so I started playing But I took lessons and then I bailed when they got hard. Mm. I remember the lesson where the piano teacher was like, you're going to play this with your right hand and this other thing with your left hand.
Like,
I was like, and I'll never see you again. So peace out. Have a good He also pronounced my name Sarah.
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 Interesting.
Yeah.
My piano teacher had really bad B.O. She did.
Oh.
I
for sure thought it was going to be a man. So a lady.
She was great, and she whenever she would lean over me, I was just like. But one of the things about my house growing up, because my family was so religious, was we in the house we didn't really ever listen to non-religious music. It was like almost consistently gospel and contemporary Christian music. And very little secular music made its way into our home. I ended up listening to it on the radio or with my friends outside of the house, but at home it was pretty much strictly gospel music.
My dad
made some exception for Motown, like some of the stuff he grew up on, but other than that, it was almost strictly gospel and Christian music.
So did it feel like an act of rebellion to sort of go towards?
It did when I was like a teenager, but now I don't feel rebellious doing it, but when I was like 13 and I tried to write love songs, that was slightly rebellious.
Did you have to keep it a secret from them at all, or were
no?
They supportive?
Well, my parents got divorced when I was like 10 or 11, so when parents
it's all out the window.
Yeah, everything's out the window. When your parents get divorced, it's like some of the rules relax a bit because you know the marriage is falling apart, and our family went through a lot because of that, and so a lot of the rules kind of eroded and evaporated, I guess.
Yeah. My parents got divorced, and my dad started buying like amplifiers and electric
midlife
guitars.
Midlife crisis.
Totally. Like, you literally don't even play
a Mustang.
This, but you just buy it. So then, when you started playing, what were like early shows for you? Like, did you start playing out for an audience when you
in were church and in school too? So my second and third grade year, I was in a Christian school called Springfield Christian School, and they would put on like Christmas musicals and things like that. And I would perform in those. And then I would sing and play at church all the time. So I just started singing in the church choir when I was like 7. And like I said, my grandmother and my mother were basically running the choir. So I would go to rehearsal with them even before I was singing in it and beg them, you know, let me sing in the choir.
Put me in, coach. Yeah.
Yes. And finally, when I was 7, they started letting me sing with the choir, and I was singing solos in front of the church, you know, at a pretty young age too. So I've always loved that feeling of being on stage, always loved that feeling of connecting with the audience and making them feel something from my performance. And it started back then.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you talk a lot to the audience when you were first? I'm thinking of like early shows for me where I was sort of finding my way as a person on stage, which I always loved being on stage too. But it was a new kind of frontier to figure out how to like hold space for an entire show. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, like, that takes a while. The idea of actually putting on a concert takes a while to figure out, because you're thinking about set lists, you're thinking about banter, you're thinking about... And when I started my as a young performer, I did almost everything at the piano. And even just getting up from the piano was like a thing for me.
Totally.
You know,
like, and, what do I do with my arms?
Yeah, what, like, how do I hold myself? But, you know, all that takes a while. But as I grew into myself, I felt more comfortable doing that, too. But it just took a while to kind of come from behind the piano and think about it beyond just here's a couple songs. But think about it. How do I put on an experience that people are going to really love?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell me about your a cappella group experience.
Yeah, so I was in a group
Did
called...
Did you know he was in an a cappella group? They all know this. They've done their research.
Some of them know.
That one knows, the one waving in the back. Any of you in
this is
acapella
all like pre-Pitch here? Perfect. Actually, the book that inspired Pitch Perfect was written by somebody that I think went to Penn or had an affiliation with Penn and interviewed one of my friends that I sang with. I went to the University of Pennsylvania, and we were in a group called Counterparts, and it was a pretty like important part of my college experience. A lot of my best friends from school I sang with, and we had a good time.
Yeah.
Did you like a cappella?
I did. Yeah. I went to UCLA, and when I got to school, I spent the first year, my freshman year, kind of searching for people that like looking for my tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw the a cappella group perform, we had a spring talent show called Spring Sing,
mm-hmm.
and I saw them perform Walk Like an Egyptian, and I was like, my people. And so I auditioned the next year and I got in, and I have journal entries where I remember I went home and was just like, I've finally found like a group of people where it was really just looking for like the misfits who, yeah, instead of like doing keg stands at a party, we were choreographing dances to Janet Jackson songs. And I'm not exaggerating.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We were like a bunch of nerds that really had such a good time just singing with each other.
And we took it very seriously.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
We did too.
The politics.
Yeah.
It was serious.
Totally.
What about theater, though? You did theater.
I didn't do it in college. I did it growing up when I was growing up. I grew up in Eureka, California, a small town, Northern California. And I did like Charlotte's Web and Little Shop of Horrors and a show called Quilters and Mystery of Edwin Drood. And so I did those. I got my feet wet doing that.
I did, in high school, I did... My first role was in the ensemble of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. That was like, I think, my freshman or sophomore year. I wasn't really like fully in the theater community, but I was friends with some of them, and then I sang with some of them in show choir, so I ended up doing the musicals. But our school had a good theater program, and, you know, we did plays, we did musicals, we did the whole gamut. We did like a one-act festival and all these other things. But I was in Charlie Brown, I was in Fiddler on the Roof. I played a Russian. I got up on the table and just, that song. And then I was one of the slaves in Big River, which is the Huckleberry Finn story. And we did that in the city park. And that was like, you know, summer theater in the park kind of thing. And
but this is all high school?
This is all during high school. Oh, and wow. I never did any more musical theater until we did Jesus Christ Superstar.
Okay, that's a great segue. Yeah. Now, we're kind of jumping very far forward in the timeline, but we can
go back, too.
We can go back.
Yes.
So, you know, we just did that.
Yes. That was fun.
That was awesome. Good job, John.
We did it.
I have to say, I've never in my life experienced someone who is as unflappable as John Legend. Like, I never saw you for 1 second get anxious. I mean, maybe you were feeling, were you feeling anything internally? Because truly, from the outside, it was like, this asshole is about to go play Jesus on national television, and he's like, I gotta go to a quick Asian tour, and then I'm gonna come back, and then we're gonna have like 5 days of rehearsal, and then we're gonna be cool. He's like, this is gonna be fun.
Yeah, I really had fun.
So did I.
And it's not, I don't really get nervous, but I do get excited. but it's all inside. But I was really excited. I was like, we had a great dress rehearsal on the Saturday before the show, and I just felt like we were gonna have a really good show, and I just felt good about it, and I was excited, but I wasn't nervous. I just felt like, this is going to be good. And we had such a great team. Like, the whole cast was so good. The NBC team and everybody that they brought in to make all the trains run on time and everything else. It was just a quality team from top to bottom. And I felt really supported, and I felt like it was going to go well. And it did.
It did go well.
Yeah.
It did go well.
Yeah.
I mean, we had the dress rehearsal on Saturday night, the night prior. There were like some things that went wrong that
night.
Yes,
the broken stool.
Broken stool. With John and I walking across the stage to a bench that's like supposed to be there, and then there was no bench there.
Yeah.
We just kept moving on, but I don't know, I sort of appreciated that happened.
It was like an icebreaker of sorts, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay, we all mess up sometimes.
Totally.
Yeah.
So what was... I know you don't get nervous, but were there fears of what could go wrong, or?
Well, I always think about my voice and making sure like it's going to be ready. So I'm like warming up, making sure it's ready to go. And the kind of the fundamental question, I guess, for me before the show, before even getting involved in the show, was that I'm not a true first tenor, and there's some parts of the musical that require kind of a first tenor's voice. And I'm more like a second tenor. I don't know if you guys know a lot about these voice parts, but my voice is lower than, say, like a Bruno Mars or Michael Jackson. My voice is more deep, and it's richer down here, which is cool, but there's certain high notes that I don't hit with the same ability that they do. And there's a few notes in the show that are like that for me for Jesus Christ Superstar, so I had to kind of figure out how I would make it fit my voice and make it work. But that was kind of a fundamental question, but I think we tackled that in rehearsal, and I felt good about where I was going to be for that. And then it's just a matter of going out there and doing it.
Yeah. Well, you have incredible pitch, though.
Like
you are a master of your machine here in your voice.
Well, we've been singing, both of us, for a long time, and I think a lot of it is just experience. You get used to figuring out how to call up those notes and make it work. And I was watching a master here do it every day.
You're right.
It was an honor.
So glad you brought that up.
It was an honor to do it with you every day.
The only question I ever got is, does John Legend smell good?
He kind of smelled like his piano teacher.
No, it's like, that's a good day. That's a good day working.
I wear cologne for you every day.
No, yeah, you didn't smell like BO once. Even in your deep Vs. Those tank tops should
have
their own.
I wore my shirt pretty deep today. Just
good.
In honor
inspired by
Jesus.
Jesus. Okay, so we're going to go backwards in time a little bit and talk about getting into... So I just did a little masterclass with some of the students at NYU from the Clive Davis Institute there.
Oh, cool.
And it was so awesome, and they had the coolest questions. But us getting started, I mean, we're around the same age, and the industry has changed a lot.
Yeah.
And so what was getting into a professional sphere as a young artist, what was that like for you? And like, did you have one of those, this is my big break moment, holy shit, everything's changed?
Well, a lot of it happened here in this city. I moved here to New York a year after I graduated from Penn. I was working as a management consultant, which is a little crazy.
I saw that when I read your
Wikipedia. You're like, no, that can't be true.
And I'm like, what?
So for 3 years, I worked at a company called Boston Consulting Group. The first year was in Boston, and years 2 and 3 were here in New York. And the reason why I wanted to transfer to New York, of course, was because if I can make it there.
Right.
And, you know, I figured as a musician, this would be a better place to try to launch my career. And I knew that this was what I really wanted to do. And so I moved here.
But wait, really quickly, like, what are you doing at this job?
So, it's hard to explain. I still can't explain it very well. But
it's like Chandler from Friends. Like, we don't know what he does, but he comes here every day.
So what happens is they come to your campus. They come and recruit at your campus. And, like, at Penn, Wharton is there, so it's a very kind of business-driven campus. And so a lot of your friends are interviewing for investment banks. And a lot of your friends are interviewing for management consulting firms. And you start to, like, talk to them and some of the ones that graduated and came back to recruit you. And you find out a little bit about what they do. And it's just kind of a bunch of pretty smart people that go into businesses and analyze what's going wrong or analyze what needs to be improved and give recommendations on what to do. So you do a lot of research. You do a lot of analysis. You talk to customers. You look at competitors, and you try to give people advice on how to make their company better. And they hire, you know, fresh graduates for us to do, like, all the research and do the interviews and all the grunt work, basically, and write the presentations. And I did that for 3 years.
Oh, my God.
I enjoyed it. It was, like, interesting group of people. And I learned a little bit about business, and I guess I carried some of that with me and just thinking about how to run my own life.
But, well, yeah, you seem to move into a lot of different zones pretty easily.
I think it helped to be around those kinds of people and think about the questions that they would ask, and it helps me think about my own business. But I did it for 3 years, and during those years, once I moved to New York especially, I was writing songs all the time. I was going to sessions at night. I was playing at gigs around here, like SOBs and Joe's Pub and Sugar Bar and Elbow Room and all these places around here, Downtime, all these places. I was doing little gigs, and I would invite all my friends who I got graduated with, because a lot of my friends moved to New York. I would invite just new people that I met. And then as I started to meet people in the actual music industry, I would invite more and more of them. And one of the people that was a friend or a relative of a friend of mine was Kanye West. So
that's convenient.
Yeah. So I went to school with this guy, Devon Harris, and he was a roommate of mine in college, and we also were roommates in New York together. And he had this cousin that moved to New York from Chicago, and He wasn't famous. He was just some cousin that made beats, as far as I knew. But he was Kanye West before everybody knew who Kanye West was. And he came to New York, and he started working a lot with Rockefeller Records. He worked on The Blueprint, which came out back in 2001. And his big song was H to the Izzo. That was the first big beat that he made that kind of put him on the map as a producer. And so my roommate Devon was like, you got to meet my cousin Kanye. He's working on Jay-Z's album. He's working with Beanie Siegel. He's working with all these guys from Rockefeller.
You're so lucky, because every time anybody ever tells me, you got to meet my cousin.
Trust me.
It's like the worst cousin. It's like the worst possible version of a cousin.
Yes. So this was a good cousin to me.
Yeah,
I've met some other cousins too.
You are anointed. No wonder you're Jesus. Okay.
I've met some other cousins too, but but they always say luck is when opportunity meets preparation, or preparation meets opportunity. And so part of it is just being prepared and working on your craft. And then when the opportunity comes along, you're able to seize that. And so we were both new. We were up and coming artists. People didn't even know he could rap really yet. Yeah. And he had to like convince people he could rap. And he was working on his demo. He was living in an apartment in Newark. And I would go to his place and we would work on songs. He would give me beats for my demo and I would write to them, and then I would sing hooks on his. And he got a deal as a rapper with Rockefeller as well. And then he still had to convince people that he could rap. I think they gave him a deal more so he could just make beats for them, and they just wanted to keep him in-house. But eventually he convinced everybody, like, I'm an artist. Like, yeah. I'm not just a producer. I'm an artist. And oh, by the way, I signed this really cool kid named John Legend from Ohio, and you should sign him too. And so eventually he helped me get signed to Columbia, and I got signed in May 2004 and put out Get Lifted in December of 2004.
Damn. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah, but it took, you know, even those years of working with Kanye, it took like 3 years working with him before it all happened. But before that, I was writing a lot and playing a lot around town. And so I'd say I started in earnest trying to get a record deal in 98 when I was still in college. The first record I ever played on was Miss Education of Lauryn Hill.
I know.
Miss Education of Lauryn Hill. 20th anniversary this year.
One of the greatest.
She just announced a tour, yes. I'm very excited to see that tour. And I met her through a friend. I was playing at a church in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I was going to school in Philly. I would drive up on Sundays to play at this church in Scranton. And one of the young ladies in the choir was a friend of Lauryn Hill's. And she was like, you should come with me and
meet my friend.
And meet my friend Lauryn Hill. And so
can I just have a little of what you're having? Yeah, okay.
And so that was the first record I played on. And then after that, I started meeting producers that I wanted to work with, and we started making demos. And so from 98 to 2004, it took 6 years to get a deal. But once it happened, I was ready. My album was basically already written, and we just kind of re-recorded some of the songs and put out Get Lifted.
So when you're, I'm curious about how you decide about collaboration. Do you go on a gut instinct? Are you kind of surveying from the outside in as to like who is a tastemaker? How do you sort of go towards what you make?
Most of it I just base on listening to records. Like if I hear a really cool album, like my last album, Blake Mills produced it, and I loved what he did on Sound and Color, the Alabama Shakes album. Mm. And I was like, I want to work with whoever produced this. And then we just called him up and we met and talked for a little bit. Talked about what we wanted to do together, and we made an album called Darkness and Light together. And so a lot of my collabs are just, oh, I really like these records. Who made them? And let's call them up.
And do you listen? How do you consume new music? Like, how do you find new music you listen
to? I listen to the radio sometimes, and I also just kind of read. I'll look at different publications and see what people are talking about and just check it out. And if I hear a few songs I like, then I'll get the album and just kind of live with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
I feel like I'm starting to get to that age now where I'm like, new music sucks.
That's like, a real thing, though. Like, when you start turning, you're like, oh, shit, I'm old because I'm talking about how my hip hurts all the time. And I, like, can't relate to what's on the radio anymore. Like, oh, this is a real thing that happens. I'm like,
back in my day, hip-hop was much better. It's funny, though. But I do still find some new music I like, and there's some artists that I think are exciting. And if you listen to that stuff and you find people you want to collaborate with, that's usually how I decide who I want to collaborate with. And then other times, I'm just writing and trying to write a great song. And then sometimes I'll think, oh, it would be cool if this person sang it with me, or if I got a verse from this rapper or something like that. And so a lot of times it'll be just based on the music itself, saying, oh, it'd be nice to hear this person's voice on it, or I think someone else could contribute something to it.
Have you had any, like, disasters that you don't have to name names, but, like, a collaboration or an experience that was, like, that didn't work?
Well, I think of every time I go in the studio as a discovery process. So some songs just don't get put out, you know?
Yeah.
But I usually finish the song no matter what. It's kind of like a goal of mine. It's like, if I go in the studio and we start a song, we're going to finish it. And that just helps me be more prolific. But it doesn't mean that every song's going to be good. It just means I'm going to try to finish it and see if I can make it great. And if not, then I just won't put it out. And so most of my experiences, even just collaborating with other people, sometimes it just doesn't work. Like, the music doesn't sound that great. The vibe isn't great. And
do you have any that are like, that's embarrassing?
Not really. Because if I got to the point
where... That is the best answer.
But
no.
See, if I got to the point where we kept working on it long enough for me to finish it and record a demo of it, then I'm probably not embarrassed by it. But there's so many I didn't put out, so there's like...
Roll the tape.
There's like scores. There's like literally scores of them that I haven't put out. And so... they weren't good enough for me to put out, at least at that time. Or
so what do you do with all that material?
I don't know. What do you do with yours?
Well, I'm embarrassed by them, so they're going to die a slow, painful death. I have a song that I wrote for. So I wrote the music for a show called Waitress. And thank you.
We love Waitress.
Ohio. So over the course of writing for the show, it's a lot of trial and error, and you're... sometimes writing songs for scenes that don't end up in the show. Mm-hmm. And one of the most embarrassing moments I have as a creator at all is being in one of the early workshops. And I had been given the assignment of writing a song for this scene between the main character, Jenna, and her abusive husband. And in the movie, he's sort of trying to be sweet and saying, will you please have sex with me? And he's just like, oh, please, please. It's like very uncomfortable to watch. And even more uncomfortable to write a song about. So the only thing I could do to make a song happen for that was to make him spell out the words, please have sex with me. So the song literally goes, P-L-E-A. A-S-E-H-A-V-E-S-E-X with me. That's the chorus of the song.
I love it.
So this poor actor gets the fucking role.
I feel like that might be an R. Kelly song, too.
That's a great idea. It was horrifying. And this poor guy who had to just sing the song because these sweet actors get given the material, and whether it's good or bad, they have to just do the best they can with it.
I have to know about this process of writing a Broadway show. Please explain.
I imagine you're going to do it.
When people ask me, I was doing all these interviews for Jesus Christ Superstar, they were like, would you ever do Broadway? I was like, if I do it, I'd probably do it like Sarah did it. I would want to write the music and do it that way.
John.
I want to be like Sarah when I grow up. And so please explain, if I were to do that, what's the process like?
Well, it's long as fuck, and you. If I had known what I was signing up for, I actually don't think I would have said yes. But I am so glad that I did. Mm. I just went in with so much naivete.
Yeah.
But it's years of your life and more man hours than I ever would have imagined. But it's so much. What I experienced was sort of a return to that. The beginning stages of being like a young artist where you don't know what you're doing yet. Mm-hmm. And so there's this constant sense of discovery.
So who are you talking to? Like, so who says we want to make a musical based on Waitress? Was it your idea or was someone coming to you?
Someone came to me. Uh-huh. So the producers had acquired the rights to this movie to make.
That's with Carrie Russell.
Carrie Russell, mm-hmm. who I still haven't met. Is she here tonight? Because I would love to make that happen.
I was watching The Americans, and I was like, I wonder if Carrie has gone to see Waitress yet.
I don't think she has.
Interesting.
Which makes me wonder if maybe it's not that good.
Oh, interesting. Okay, but, anyway. Anyway,
you're talking to the director. The producers had acquired the rights, and a director was affiliated already with the project. Mm-hmm. So then I got approached to see if I would be interested in exploring, and... Yeah, we had lunch. The director and I had lunch, and she told me about the project. And I hadn't seen the movie at the time, so I went home and watched the film. And I liked the film. I didn't love the film. Mm-hmm. And I think that was also... It's kind of like the beautiful thing about... It's a beautiful movie, but it's not the movie where you're like, please don't touch that. Like, just let that be.
Yeah, you're like, thing. I could do something to make this even better.
Yeah, it like felt like there was room for it to sing in a way. And so then, I said yes, and we kind of went on this path, and that's been the last, 5 years of my life.
So did you talk to Broadway songwriters kind of about any differences there might be in pop songwriting versus Broadway songwriting?
I didn't do a lot of that kind mm-hmm. of research. I think a little bit on purpose because I was trying to stay really... I did listen to records. Mm-hmm. Like, I listened to some of the cast albums of big shows, but mm-hmm. I kind of grew up doing that anyway.
Yeah.
So...
I didn't. I guess I need to do that if I'm going to do it.
Yeah. You should check it out and see some theater. But you've already ventured into theater. You have a Tony Award, which is fucking awesome, for Jitney.
Yes,
right?
Jitney, best revival last year.
Did any of you see this? The show was unbelievably good.
It was really great. Great direction and great actors. And it was the last August Wilson show that hadn't been on Broadway yet. And so we brought it to Broadway.
Yeah. How did that come to you?
Well, I have a company called Get Lifted Film Company. My partners are here, Mike Jackson and Ty Stikoris. They're here today. And people know we're in business, and so people bring us ideas, you know, and we want to help great art get out there, great creative people get their stories out. And when we see a project that we think our involvement will help it get made and help it be a success, and if we think it's something we can be proud of, then we get involved.
And you started this in 2014, is that right?
I'm not sure,
right?
Maybe. I don't know when we started, honestly. But, you know,
what was the impetus for actually making that come to...
Well, Mike brought the idea to me because he had been working in TV and film production for years, and he knew that I was working with filmmakers as a musician. I was writing songs for film, and he began to see that my name and my involvement in projects would help, you know, make them happen. And he was like, we should join together and start making some of these projects happen. And so we started working with filmmakers and some great television shows. We did Underground for 2 years mm-hmm. at WGN America. And then we got involved in theater as well. The first thing we did was a one-man show about Dick Gregory called Turn Me Loose. And then Jitney was the next project we did.
And is there more? What's on the horizon for your production company right now?
Jesus Christ Superstar, we were involved as executive producer of that too, and so that was pretty cool. And then we've got a documentary tonight that's part of our slate. It's called United Skates, so it's premiering here at Tribeca, so you should check that out. And if any judges are in the house, you know, jury members. But and then we've got quite a few TV and film projects that we're looking at. We just kind of wait to announce them. To when they're ready.
Do you ever feel spread thin? Or how do you balance the fact that you're working and you're successful in so many different areas at the same time?
A lot of it's just delegation and working with people that I really trust and knowing that I don't have to show up for every meeting and every single thing if I trust them to do the right thing.
Yeah.
I don't feel overworked or overstressed. I actually slept less in college and my first few years out of college than I sleep now. I get more rest now. I feel like I know how to balance my life better.
He told me he naps. He naps before every show. I nap before every show.
I spend a lot of time with my family, and I don't feel overworked at all. I just feel like I choose when I need to be somewhere, and if I don't need to be there, then I focus on what I love to do, which is being with my family and writing songs and making music.
Are you writing songs about Luna?
I have written songs about Luna. I wrote a song about her on my last album, Darkness and Light. It's called Right By You. I've already started thinking about songs for my son, who's coming soon. He'll be here. Soon, like probably like a month from now, he'll probably be here.
Yeah. Is she prepared for being a big sister?
I have no idea. I don't.
She's pretty young.
I don't think she has an idea yet. I've been getting advice from friends about how to introduce him to her. We'll try to do it right. But
when we brought my sister has two girls, and the oldest one was like going to be, it was going to be an issue to have.
I think Luna's going to be an issue too.
Oh, really?
Yes.
She came home, Megan, the little one, came home from the hospital with a gift. We put a gift in the carrier.
Yeah, that's what my friend told me just now. Like, it needs to have a gift. Yeah. And also, I've heard that I should bring Luna in to him. So it doesn't feel like we're all just sitting there with this new guy.
Yeah.
And like, who this? Yeah. So we'll see. We'll figure it out. I think she'll probably have some growing pains when it comes to that, because she's running the house right now.
Aww.
And she's two. She's talking a lot. She's used to being the center of everything right now.
Yeah.
So we'll see how she adjusts to that. To sharing the spotlight.
Yeah, that's never easy. Siblings are never easy, but you know.
I was number two in my family, and my older brother, he travels with me all the time, and he works with me. He cuts my hair. He like takes all the photos you see on my Instagram of all the shows, and he's always been really like supportive of me and taking good care of me. So I have a good example of what a good older sibling should be like.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's really cool. Mm-hmm. That there's not. Because it can be challenging when you have one of a brood that's like getting a lot of attention where, you know, it can be an imbalance sometimes.
Yeah, my brother is good with it. He's really good.
That's great. My sisters are too.
Good.
Great.
How many siblings do you have?
I have two older siblings and a younger half sibling.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's four of us too.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll go bowling.
We'll do Family Feud.
But don't fucking bring Kanye West.
We need one more.
He's going to show up. He's like, I got a friend. It's going to be like the Obamas. Actually, I would love to go bowling with the Obamas.
They'd probably be fun to bowl with.
I'm sure they will. Okay. So another little tidbit from the other night with these young folks. Do you have a mistake that you made early in your career that you wish, or like advice you would give to yourself early on that you sort of wish you had?
I think whenever I felt like I didn't do something the right way is because I didn't trust myself to be myself, and I tried to be something that I wasn't really. And so I think the key for me has been to be as true to myself as I can be, and like trust my inner kind of compass to tell me the right thing to do. I don't feel like I've made a lot of big mistakes publicly, but I think whenever I haven't felt good about something is when I did it for the wrong reason.
Yeah.
Or I did it like not with at the core, where the core wasn't, do I love this and is this art that I really believe in?
Yeah.
And so I think for any artist, I think the key is to leave that as your true north, where you're saying, is this really art that I am proud of and I believe in, and it comes from me and it reflects who I am in a way that I'm proud of. If you stick with that and don't make a lot of decisions chasing things out of fear or out of pressure or out of trying to chase a trend or whatever it is, if you do that, I think you won't make a lot of decisions you regret.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And getting trust, surrounding yourself like you were talking about, surrounding yourself with people you trust.
Yeah.
That you can bounce ideas off. Because there's a lot of chaos,
yeah.
Sort of like organized chaos in this business.
And I think with any business, personnel is so key. Like, it's so like who you have working for you, who you have working with you, who you choose to collaborate with. Is so determinative of what the result's going to be. It doesn't mean that everything you do is going to be great, but the chances of it being great are much better.
Much higher.
Yeah, if you work with great people. And so I think a key for me has been just collaborating, employing the right people.
Have you ever had to fire someone you love?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I've had to let, well, yeah, people that I was really close to, yeah.
Yeah.
I've had to let them go. And it's tough. But once you get it done, it's like,
yeah.
It's like, because you know you did it for the right reason. Like, especially if you really care about that person, you got close to them.
Yeah.
If you let them go, then you must be doing it for the right reason, or you wouldn't do it. You know,
I've had. And to do sort that. Of, if it's meant to be, usually they'll be around in the next iteration.
Maybe, I mean, like, maybe just it's not good for you for them to be around. I've had people that was like once I did it, I was like, wow, I'm so glad I did that, you know? And just certain energies aren't good for you to be creative and for your life to be peaceful and be what it needs to be. And once it's gone, it's like a weight off your shoulder.
Peaceful. Just the most peaceful man, right? It's the best.
Peace is good. I mean, it's not the only thing we should care about, I think.
No, and you don't shy away from that either.
Yeah, sometimes you need some tension, you know, and I think tension's good too, but it needs to be worth it if you're going to have tension.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so let's talk about politics a little bit and the intersection of being an artist and being in the political sphere. Like, you're very outspoken, and I happen to agree with 100% of the things that you're saying.
100%?
No, but how do you handle any sort of negative feedback for getting, or have you ever had people sort of basically be like shut up and sing kind of thing, you know?
I get that all the time, but that's on Twitter. I mean, like, you get everything on Twitter.
Right, that's true.
But there's, I think, first of all, anytime you talk about politics, there's at least like 35% of the country that won't agree with you on just about any subject. And some people, if they don't agree with you, they're like, that's fine. I don't agree with that person. We're different people. I still like his music, or I still, you know, whatever. They're fine with it. But other people, they look at it as you're on the other team and I can't be on the same team as you. I don't want to buy your music. I won't support you. I want you destroyed.
Yeah.
So there's a few people like that. But I figure they probably weren't buying my music anyway. That's just my guess. They probably weren't buying my music anyway, and so I haven't lost that much. But I feel like there is a risk, you know? There is a risk to being involved in politics. There's a risk to advocating causes that aren't popular. I think a lot of times we forget how unpopular even Dr. Martin Luther King was. He was underwater. His approval rating was underwater when he was alive. So, I mean, we glorify him now, we deify him now almost, but he wasn't popular. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of things that are worth fighting for, there will be challenges, there will be risks to speaking out, and you may lose some fans, you may lose some popularity. But I'm at the point in my life now where I just don't care about losing those people. If I can make some change that's actually meaningful, then I want to fight for that change and speak out for things I believe in, because it's just the best way for me to be true to who I am and to feel like my life is meaningful and that I'm not wasting this awesome blessing that I have to be where I am in life.
Right. Now, does that feel like something you had to grow into? Because I totally agree with you, but I can remember a time in my life where I was really concerned with what people thought and said about me. And I find that that's, as I've gotten older, that's kind of diminished, but
I think we're lying to ourselves if we say we don't care what people think about
us.
Of course. But I do care, but I also think there's more important things than trying to please, you know, every, you know, far right, you know, person in the country. Like, I can't make all of them happy. I don't agree with them on a lot of things.
Yeah.
And I can't just go around not being honest about who I am and what I think about things. And so, and particularly now, because I feel like there's a sense of urgency that I feel, because I'm really worried for our country, I'm worried for the world, and I feel like this is no time to sit on the sidelines, as far as I'm concerned, because I think sitting on the sidelines basically means you're saying this is okay.
Yeah.
And I'm not with that. Yeah.
Yes. I also find that when you're standing and speaking from your true north, your truth, somehow it just doesn't, I don't know, the fire doesn't hit as hard or something. Yeah. There's something about that.
And Paul Robeson said that artists are the gatekeepers of truth. And I feel like what defines us as artists is our willingness to tell the truth. And the thing that people fall in love with as an artist, the thing that your fans love about you is you. Like, are you being yourself? Are you being true and authentic? And if you give them that, then I think it makes them even love you more, and it makes them even more loyal to you as a fan and as a supporter. And so I don't even think it's bad business to be honest. I think it's good business to be honest. I think it as an artist, it's the best place to be. And fear is like the worst driver. You can't let fear drive you as an artist.
No, it distorts everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Speak from love, speak from truth, and it's all going to be better if you do it that way. It's going to work way better than fear would.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, we're going to go to that. That's a perfect segue.
All right.
To opening up to our audience. What a joy it is to talk to you.
My pleasure,
Sarah.
I'm
such a fan.
My pleasure.
Okay, we're going to open it up to some audience questions. You in the back. Yeah.
Good evening, John. Good evening, Sarah. I had a question for you, John, about your writing process, composing and writing music by yourself. For the most part, you collaborate with a lot of people on your albums, but I find that I enjoy your music more, or your songs more, when you compose alone, songs like Again or songs like Shine. Tell me about when you
Good
decide.
To know that I did those on my own. It's not a lot.
So just if you could tell me about the process of writing a song and when you make the decision to work with somebody, or if someone brings something, you collaborate with them, and also your songwriting process of when you do something on your own.
Well, it's interesting. I think I love writing on my own, but I also feel like sometimes I'll get stuck in a little bit of a creative rut if I only write by myself. And so I like to bounce ideas off of other people. But those are a couple of my favorite songs of mine, too. So I'm like, maybe I should write by myself more. But I also like the idea of someone else's energy kind of pushing me in different directions, because it helps me make, I think, a more dynamic kind of repertoire of music. Because if I wrote all the songs myself, then I'm afraid they'll be a little too consistent and like a little too much like each other. And it's good to like have other ideas to kind of bounce off of and other energy to bounce off of. So I like probably a balance, but I'm in my mind, I'm like reconsidering, maybe I should write some more by myself. So thank you for bringing that up.
And sometimes writing with other people, then you go home and write by yourself. You know,
yeah.
I don't know, you know, like you'll go to a session and for whatever reason, if it's good or bad or whatever,
yeah,
then it actually fuels, it all fuels the
yeah
machine, you know?
And I think it's good sometimes to write with other people just because it keeps that muscle being worked when you might not have the inspiration to do it all by yourself at that moment,
yeah,
but it keeps that muscle from kind of atrophying.
Awesome. Yeah. Good question.
Hi, I have a question for John. What was the process like creating your version of History Has Its Eyes on You? Because I know that the character of George Washington was inspired by John Legend in Common from the revolutionary musical Hamilton. And I'm just curious because when it first dropped, I just lost my mind. And I'm just curious how you...
You were the only one.
Like,
not catching on at all.
We got to root for that show Hamilton. And
yeah,
somebody needs to discover that show.
Yeah.
No, but what she's saying is there was a casting call that went out, and when Lin-Manuel sent it out, the description of who George Washington should be was a mix of John Legend and Common. And so that's what she's referring to. And then History Has Its Eyes on You was a song that they asked me to make for the Hamilton mixtape. And I listened to it, and I wanted to write it and sing it the way I wanted to sing it. And I decided to make it more like kind of a gospel quartet kind of vibe. And like I told you guys, I grew up singing gospel music, and I still love that music. And I decided to make a version that felt like that to me. It kind of completely changed the musical structure and melody of the song, but kept the lyrics. I was really happy with it. I'm glad you liked it. It just felt like home to me. It felt like the way I would write it or sing it, and I wanted it to feel like that.
Sarah, I wanted to ask you, when you wrote the songs for Waitress, did you ever imagine yourself in that role, and what was it like taking on that role and being able to sing your own songs on the Broadway stage?
That was one of those pinch me moments of little kid fantasy coming to life. I think when I was writing the songs, I was so myopic and so short-sighted about what the process was going to feel like. It was just one song at a time, one foot in front of the other. I did an entire concept record of myself singing the entire score to the show, which is the most narcissistic thing you can ever do. You're like, let me write these songs for a show, but you know what would be great is if I sing everything. No, that one didn't make it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But I'll send it to you. And so there was obviously something in me that was very attached to the material, but I didn't really consider it until we got to the end of Jesse Mueller's run, who was our original leading lady and is astoundingly talented. And then, you know, I'm in all the casting conversations, and it became...
You're like when Dick Cheney picked himself as the VP.
It's the same thing. In the back?
I have two things. One, Sarah, I have girls who are 8, 6, and 5, and we sing love song like they've known it forever.
Oh, wow.
So I just want to thank you for that.
Thank you.
And John, my question is for you. I feel like longevity is key in the music industry nowadays. What tips can you give artists that are coming up now?
I don't know. Well, it's interesting because, first of all, when I write songs, I want them to last forever. I want them to feel like you can listen to them 20 years from now. And I've always been kind of an old soul. And so I've always listened to music that was older than me. And I've always listened to music that I felt like was timeless and classic. And so to me, that was what music was supposed to be. And that's what songs are supposed to be. And so I always approached songwriting as though I wanted the song to not just be a great recording at that moment, but something that someone could cover, something that would be a standard of its own genre or of its own, you know, subject matter or whatever it was. I wanted it to last in that way. And so that's the way I approach songwriting. But it's not easy to last in this business and continue to make songs that people care about. But part of it, I think, is just doing it, like continuing to write, continuing to work on your craft and care about every concert, every tour, making sure it's the best one you've had yet. And I think sometimes people get fatigued by this business. I think sometimes people, like I talked about before, operate out of fear and not out of love and out of truth. A lot of times it's just a lot for people. It's like psychologically a lot for people to deal with fame and all the other things that come with it. And so some people just kind of, they can't handle it for some reason or another. But I think if you just keep going, like keep showing up, keep writing, keep like working, the chances are better that you're going to succeed over a long period of time than if you're kind of like, if you lose that persistence and that commitment to your craft and to being the best you can be.
Because that's also like staying focused on the work as opposed to the outcome.
Yeah.
It's like if you're lit up by the work that you
do. Yeah, if you like love songwriting, keep going back and writing more.
Write songs.
And you're not thinking about, well, is this going to be on top of the Hot 100 or whatever. You're just thinking, I want it to be great. And I want to enjoy this process of writing and recording. I want it to be awesome. And that's what drives me when I go to the studio. Like, that is it. That's what I want. And I figure if I keep going that way and I keep being motivated by that and my love for music and the love for the craft, and someone said a big part of show business is just showing up. And I feel like showing up means not just showing up for your show and being on time and giving people a great show. Like, I'm so inspired by watching Beyonce because you can tell she works. Like, she works on that show. Mm-hmm. She is committed to every move, every step being right. And she's been around this long. One, because she's immensely talented, but two, because she really cares about her craft and she works on it all the time. She shows up when she's supposed to show up. And I think that's a big part of longevity.
This is the last question. This is the last question. It better be amazing.
The pressure. Thank you so much to both of you for sharing your stories with us. And Sarah, thank you so much because your music has been basically the soundtrack of my life for the past 10 years.
Thank you very much for that.
I was wondering, as an aspiring musical writer, which is indeed damn hard, do you have writing tips? Like, what's your discipline when you're tackling a new project, whether it is a soundtrack, an album, a musical?
I think a big part of it is setting goals that you can achieve, even though you have a big goal, like setting smaller goals. I know for some people that write, you know, novels or whatever, it's like, I just need to write every day for this amount of hours. for songwriters, for me, I want to write whenever I make the time to focus on songwriting, I want to go in and write a song every day. And that's how I think about it. And so part of it is just setting those manageable goals for yourself, I think, and holding yourself to them, giving yourself some kind of accountability. Maybe it's setting time aside and a space aside where, you know, this is where I work, this is where I focus, and I'm not going to, you know, check my Twitter, I'm not going to do this or that. I'm going to focus on writing for that period of time. I think that's a very helpful way to think about the project of writing. And the best way to get the best writing out of yourself is to write. You have to write.
I would say at least something wonderful that I learned from the process of writing for the musical was to not be so precious about sharing ideas at an early stage, because I've always been incredibly private about that. And I found that if you have collaborators you trust who won't laugh at the bad ideas. I mean, nobody saved me from Please Have Sex With Me, but like, you know, good ideas usually will prevail longer than the bad ones. But I found it was an easier flow to get in if I would share ideas sooner, which was a huge light bulb moment for me, because like, if someone likes what you do, it's inspiring, and then you get to go back and keep working on it and craft it more. But so yeah. Good luck with you. And thank you all so much.
Thank you, everybody.
Amazing. And thank you, John Legend.
That was great.
The Tribeca Film Festival takes place every year in New York City. To learn more about all of our programs, head to TribecaFilms.com.